This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. In the news this week, the sound and the fury of the presidential race, Rick Perry resurrects charges that Mitt Romney hired undocumented workers.
Those people that hire illegals ought to be penalized. And Mitt, you lose all of your standing from my perspective because you hired illegals.
Which certainly raised the temperature of the debate.
This has been a tough couple of debates for Rick. And I understand that. And so you're going to get testing.
Meanwhile, redistricting in Massachusetts, Beacon Hill lawmakers double the number of minority-majority districts.
These maps truly, I believe, reflect the many, many faces of the Commonwealth.
And following the money in the race to unseat Senator Scott Brown, challenger Elizabeth Warren raises more than $3 million, most of it from out of the state.
So joining us now are two members of our Week in Review stable. Peter Kanellos, editorial page editor at the Boston Globe. Good to have you as always, Peter. Welcome back.
Thanks, Anthony.
And from the State House, Kyle Chaney, reporter for the State House News Service. Kyle, good to have you back and welcome.
Good to be here.
So, gentlemen, let's start with the heat on the presidential trail between Mitt Romney and Texas Governor Rick Perry. As we heard in the introduction, Perry went on the attack and laid into Romney, resurrecting an old charge, accusing the former Massachusetts governor of hiring undocumented workers to landscape his home in Belmont back in 2006. Let's listen to a little bit of the exchange.
We hired a lawn company to mow our lawn, and they had illegal immigrants that were working there. And when that was pointed out to us, we let them go. And we went to them and said, you have a problem with allowing someone to finish speaking. And I suggest that if you want to become president of the United States, you got to let both people speak. So first, let me speak. So we went to the company and we said, look, you can't have any illegals working on our property. I'm running for office for Pete's sake. I can't have illegals. It turns out that once again, they hired someone who had falsified their documents, had documents, and therefore we fired them.
Peter Kanellos, it was actually your crew at the Globe that first unearthed this story back in 2006. And I wanted to add a few facts here. So Romney did hire a company, not the individuals. On the other hand, as you guys reported, after he was told the company hired illegals, he went on using the company for a year or so. Is this still a potent issue for Perry to hit him with?
I think that it's probably within the bounds of fair campaigning. On the other hand, to throw it out there 4 years later does suggest a little bit of desperation on Perry's campaign. So Romney wasn't entirely wrong when he was saying, Rick's had some tough debates and now he's, trying to change the conversation.
Given that Romney, though, had to confront this very same issue back in 2008 when he was running for president the last time, I would have expected almost, a better response from him. I mean, he got angry. He said, I'm running for office for Pete's sake. I can't have illegals. It doesn't sound like a very principled position. Kyle, go ahead. You first, Peter. Go ahead.
All right. I was going to say that line also stuck out as a sore point. I'm running for office, for God's sake. But he may have unintentionally revealed some of his calculating nature there.
Well, yeah. And to add to that, too, I think he's been used to a little bit of gentle treatment in the current primary he's been in, so much so that people have been writing about him as sort of the inevitable, almost with an air of inevitability around him to become the nominee. So he may have been a little caught off guard by the fact that his opponents in the primary went on the offensive.
Yeah, and I think it might have been a little bit, maybe it surprised him because Rick Perry had done so sort of a lackluster performance in the first three debates, and suddenly he came out sort of hard charging. Let's listen to a little more of this exchange between Perry and Romney. Let's listen to this.
You say that you knew
would you
had
please, would you please wait?
Working.
Are you just going to keep talking?
Yes,
are you going to let me finish with what I have to say? Look, Rick,
this
has been a tough couple of debates for Rick, and I understand that, and so you're going to get testing.
So, gentlemen, the overall tenor of the debate between these two candidates really shifted. Do you think this, in fact, hurts the GOP, as some say it does, or are these kinds of changes all sort of part of the territory?
It does cut both ways. I think some people will say it's good practice for the eventual nominee to get really tested in these debates because it's only going to get tougher from here on out. You saw it wasn't just Romney Perry. I think there was some Romney Gingrich back and forth too. That was more of a policy wonk level. That was that also really challenged Romney. So I think he might say at the end of the day it's a way to test his strength as a candidate.
Well, they have 3 weeks to rest and prepare for the next debate. So it'll be interesting to see what emerges after 3 weeks. Let's move on a little bit, but stick with presidential news. There was news today out of New Hampshire. We learned that Michelle Bachmann's entire New Hampshire paid staff quit. According to a report, they were frustrated with how little attention she's paying to the state. Now, Bachmann has been fading in the race. She won the Iowa straw poll a while back, and she's clearly hoping for a big win in Iowa. Peter, what does pulling out of New Hampshire mean to her overall chances?
Well, I think it means that she's running out of money, and I think it also means that she is putting all her eggs in Iowa, which is not such a dumb strategy, actually, because somebody's going to win the Iowa caucuses. It could be Mitt Romney. That would be the ultimate surprise, because he's not really made that a centerpiece of his effort.
Right.
But if it was, if let's just say this, if Mitt Romney wins Iowa, I think he's almost certainly going to be the nominee. I doubt that he will at this point, because there's so many evangelical voters there in Iowa, but whether Rick Perry wins, it was once thought that that would be a very clear win for him. If he does win now, it'll look like a big comeback. The same thing if Michelle Bachmann steps in and wins. So somebody's going to win it, and she's making her big stand there.
Mm. Kyle Chaney, what's your take on Bachmann's staff up and quitting in New Hampshire?
Well, it seems like, it's funny because they came out and said, oh, this wasn't a reflection of our dissatisfaction with her candidacy. But I don't know how you just resign en masse and not reflect poorly on the person running the campaign. She's in charge. She's the manager of all of her staffs, her campaign staffs in various states. And this happened, I think, to Newt Gingrich as well a while back. So it seems to be the MO of frustrated staffers this year.
Well, let's move on to the Massachusetts Senate race and the money story. Democratic candidate Elizabeth Warren's campaign announced that she's raised more than $3 million, 70% of which came from out of state. Much of that money from national PACs, liberal groups like Emily's List and MoveOn.org, as well as a big donation from George Soros, to name just a few. Does the fact that she's getting so much from out of state provide ammunition for her opponents that says she's out of touch and not from Massachusetts? Peter Kanellis?
I think that's definitely going to be a line of attack against her, and the more that the numbers back that up, the more she's going to hear about it. She probably could have done a slightly better job so far of emphasizing her Massachusetts credibility. She spent a long time in Washington during the time that people were speculating about her candidacy and allowing national figures to step forward and suggest that she run, which I don't think did her any great help. On the other hand, she is somebody who's lived here for decades. We sometimes hold people to higher standards than that in terms of their local credibility. And she's an authentic seeming figure. I mean, I think she genuinely is comfortable on the campaign trail. So as time goes by, she should be able to address it kind of just by being present, by appearing in a lot of places, by showing her sensitivity to Massachusetts concerns. But there's no doubt that that's going to be a big line of attack for Scott Brown.
And Kyle, we should note that Senator Scott Brown raised a little over $1 million in the same period, most of it from within Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, during his first Senate campaign, he too benefited from lots of out-of-state money. So this seems to be pretty much the way modern political races go, right?
Exactly. I think that's exactly the point, is that there's a case to be made that both candidates have benefited from out-of-state interests. I think what it really reflects and really points to is just the general national interest in this race, pretty much on both sides. And I think that is sort of inevitable when you have an Elizabeth Warren type figure and a Scott Brown figure who's a Republican symbol in some ways based on his first run.
Yeah. Well, the money is always such a key part of the story, of course. The fact that Scott Brown is able to raise so much now from within the state, it's more evidence that he's still going to be a very tough incumbent to beat, right?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. He's... he's still popular here based on the latest polls, so he'll be tough in that regard. And he's also just, he's fundraised and run in Massachusetts before as a state candidate, a state senator. So it's not like he's unfamiliar with how to fundraise within the state.
There's another point to make, though. There's so much national financial services money in Massachusetts that you really have to look a little deeper at the numbers, because it may be, Massachusetts money, but it's major financial services firms and things that have a national interest in the race that get listed. So I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that any dollar that's listed as Massachusetts is mom and pop and Billerica. It may well be, Putnam and Fidelity executives downtown.
Sure. Are you suggesting those? You're saying those financial services dollars, a lot of those are going to Scott Brown, right?
I think that there's a fair amount, and I'm sure that there are some that are also going to Elizabeth Warren to cover their bets. There's no question about that. But you have to look a little deeper at the numbers. That's
sure.
My point.
Sure. Now, the other big political story this week was a bit more local, a proposal from Beacon Hill on legislative redistricting. The effort is aimed at reflecting the growing numbers of minorities in the state. And under the plan from the legislature's redistricting committee, there would be 20 new House districts and 3 new Senate districts that would be so-called majority-minority district. Here's House Redistricting Committee Chairman Mike Moran.
One of the things I'm most proud of with this map is that next year when we raise our hands to get sworn in, it's very likely that because of the work we've done here, there is going to be another Hispanic member of our House of Representatives.
Now, I misspoke a moment ago. That's 20 total House districts and 3 total Senate districts. That would be so-called majority-minority, not new districts. Mm-hmm. The plan has been set aside for 2 weeks to provide time for public comment, to consider amendment. And Peter Canellis, let me start with you on this. Your paper editorialized that this has been a pretty good faith effort on the part of lawmakers. And, of course, the history of redistricting hasn't always been straightforward in Massachusetts, right?
Yeah, I think it was a good faith effort because traditionally what happens is there's a benefit to the Democratic Party to sort of have very largely minority districts, but then also to have other liberal districts sort of surrounding it and to divide up the Democratic vote. So in other words, you'll end up with minority districts only in places that naturally have a very high number of minorities, and you don't construct any special new ones because the minority vote benefits a lot of different Democrats. In this case, they really went out of their way to create more minority seats, even at the expense of watering down some of the surrounding districts in a way that might make Democratic incumbents more vulnerable. And that's a sign of putting sort of principle ahead of incumbency protection, which is a very good thing.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because, of course, Kyle, the historic bugaboo of these kinds of processes is incumbency protection. Did you see lawmakers really avoid that pitfall this time around?
I think in general, yes, they did. I think they did put a good faith effort in, or at least went out of their way to underscore their efforts to make it an inclusive process and include input from minority advocates. I also think a great motivator is the threat of legal action, which was ever present in the entire process and became a huge factor 10 years ago. So as much as it may have been a good faith effort as well to be inclusive of minority groups and not just focus solely on incumbent protection, I do think there was also another impetus, which was to avoid the legal embarrassment that it became a decade ago.
A decade ago, which ended up with Finneran's prosecution and obstruction of justice charges, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And that was they never mentioned him in the release of these plans, but he was clearly on everyone's mind during the process.
So, Peter Canellis, how will this affect the political landscape in Massachusetts, if at all?
Well, you might see more competitive districts, as we were suggesting before, so the Republicans may actually get a little bit of a benefit out of this. But I also think we'll have a more diverse legislature, which is a good thing because the state has gotten more diverse, and yet the way the legislative districts lined up, that wasn't reflected as much on Beacon Hill.
All right, gentlemen, let's move on to the week's hubbubs, that one story that caught your attention that maybe fell below the radar. Peter, let me start with you, your hubbub.
I thought the Fessenden headmaster who brought forward immediately claims from the 1970s, this is a private school in Newton, of sexual abuse of students at the school and inviting other alumni and others to come forward if they indeed suffered these cases was a model for how to deal with these very, very difficult allegations in an open and honest way.
You guys did some great reporting on that story, by the way. I encourage listeners to check that out at boston.com. Kyle Chaney, your hubbub.
Well, the Governor's Council, it's an 8-member elected body that votes on Governor Patrick's judicial nominees, not really known for spine-tingling or exciting proceedings. It took a sort of bizarre turn this week when one of the counselors accused Governor Patrick's nominee to the state land court of once working for a group that was secretly plotting to subvert the American government in favor of an international form of government and a one-world currency. Not usually typical fare for judicial nomination proceedings.
Oh, boy. All right, on that, we're going to wrap up our week in review. Kyle Chaney, reporter for the State House News Service, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Peter Canellos, editorial page editor at the Boston Globe, a pleasure as always. Thank you.
Thanks, Anthony.